Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The president has proclaimed this Infrastructure Week. Repairing our country's crumbling roads and bridges was supposed to be an area ripe for partisan compromise. Not to be. Democrats are turning a cold shoulder to President Trump's proposed $1 trillion overhaul, even Republicans balking at some aspects of the president's plan. In this first half hour, we want to talk about Iowa's infrastructure in particular. Let's start off by hearing from Congressman Dave Loebsack, a Democrat from Iowa's 2nd District. Loebsack recently wrote a piece in the Newton Daily News about the need for long-term infrastructure investment. I spoke with him yesterday and began by asking him how he would describe the state of Iowa's roadways and bridges today.
At best, probably average. I think we have a lot of problems in the state, certainly ranging from the interstates themselves, Interstate 30, 35, and Interstate 80, all the way to the rock roads out in the county that serve especially our rural areas. I've got 24 counties. I see a lot of roads. I experience a lot of roads every single weekend when I'm back. I was just did five events on the road on Saturday. So I can kind of tell you where some of the good ones are and where some of the not so good ones are, including some of the rock roads, especially in the southern part of the district that have a lot of problems when it rains really hard.
Mm-hmm. In your article, you cited the report card by the American Society of Civil Engineers released in 2017, giving America's roads a grade of D, and the bridges received a grade of C+. So what you're seeing out there, you completely agree with this report card in your personal experience of driving Iowa's roads.
Yeah, and in fact, our bridges are even worse. We have an even higher percentage. I think we're, if not the worst in the country as far as the state, we're right near the bottom. And so we have just a whole lot of bridges. We've got this huge rural area here in the state of Iowa, relatively speaking, and with our agricultural economy, even those small bridges in the rural areas can be really critical. If one of those gives out, sometimes a farmer is going to have to travel a number of miles out of his way just to get his grain to the market. And I think it's hard for folks to understand just how important that is unless they actually go out and see what we're talking about. But I'll tell you, the average farmer can tell you how important that is.
Right. And aside from, well, a bridge goes out or something, or a bridge is unsafe and you can't, get a larger vehicle over it, that's clear what the cost of that is. We've talked about here, too, just not keeping maintenance proper on the roads, having potholes. That degrades our cars, sends them to the repair shop sooner than they would have.
Well, that's right. I mean, deferred maintenance is never a good idea, no matter whether it's a building or a road or whatever it is, because ultimately, or our health for that matter, too. Ultimately, it's going to cost more down the road to fix these roads and bridges when they need to be fixed. And they will need to be fixed eventually. It'll be such a crisis. But clearly, right, there are a lot of these costs that people don't think about. And, ultimately, if you're driving on these roads and something happens to your car as a result of the roads, you will pay a price. And I think more and more Americans get that. I think they're mm-hmm. beginning to see that because they're experiencing these roads. But Ben, if I might, I kind of want to broaden it out. It's not just roads and bridges. I mean, it's locks and dams along the Mississippi River. It's rural broadband, as you know, too. That's a part of our infrastructure, a very important part of our infrastructure. And some of us would like to invest quite a bit more money into both of those kinds of projects. And the locks and dams. I was just on a towboat pushing a barge on the Mississippi around Muscatine not long ago, and we're talking about several billions of dollars that it's going to take to upgrade those locks and dams, and in particular since the Panama Canal has been upgraded, they can accommodate bigger barges with more grain, and that means that from the Mississippi River, you look at a radius from the Mississippi River, we can include more grain from more of Iowa that could go on those bigger ships, those bigger barges, and you know, that would help, in fact, get better prices for the grain for those farmers who live farther away from Mississippi River. So, you know, it's really important, not to mention our competition with soybean producers in Brazil. It's really, really important.
Congressman, I guess there is no disagreement that we have a real problem in terms of our infrastructure. This week, President Trump is to announce his plans for the nation's infrastructure, according to the New York Times, a plan that involves sharply curtailing the federal government's funding, calling upon states, cities, corporations to shoulder most of the cost of rebuilding these things, roads, bridges, railways, waterways. What is your take on that plan?
Well, that's where the crunch is going to come. I think almost all of us can agree that we probably got to put $1 trillion into our infrastructure in the coming years, over whatever time period we're talking about, at most 10 years, to deal with all these problems that we have. The question is going to be how we're going to pay for it. And look, I understand that, you know, the president's going to lay out principles having to do with this. I really wish that at this point, I mean, he's been in office now a number of months. This has been highly anticipated. I really wish that he could be a lot more specific. Principles are fine, but we really need specifics as to exactly how he's thinking about paying for this. Mm-hmm. And the one of the basic problems, I mean, there are a couple of different things. If he's relying primarily upon states and local governments, we've seen what's happened in Iowa. There's a huge shortfall right now in our budget in Iowa. There are a lot of reasons for that. That Iowa's not unique. That's happening all over the country. I think it's probably not acceptable to sort of foist this burden onto local governmental entities. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I think from what I hear, he's talking about maybe as little as 20% of this funding being accounted for at the federal level. The other thing is you know, if there's a reliance on, for example, so-called public-private partnerships with the intention of somehow reducing taxes and providing tax incentives for companies to carry out these large-scale projects. The problem for rural America, and it's not just Democrats talking about this, a lot of rural Republicans, the problem is that the incentives that might be provided are not necessarily going to lead to the kinds of development of projects that we need in rural America, because these companies are not going to find it in their bottom-line interest necessarily to do the work that we need in Iowa. So there are a lot of concerns that I have. I'm going to wait and see the specifics to the extent to which they provide them, but I have a lot of concerns about this idea.
At a federal level, talking with your fellow legislators in the House, perhaps also in the Senate, how would you characterize the partisan differences on this issue? Recognizing the need for an investment in infrastructure, but as you say, the crunch being in how do you pay for it? What are the partisan differences there?
You know, there are differences, and they are by party. There's no question. But as I just mentioned, there are a heck of a lot of rural Republican representatives who have exactly the same concerns I have about making sure that the funding, as it is going to provide the kind of investments that we need to have in rural America. This is not partisan at all. There's bipartisan concern about this. It hasn't been expressed quite so much publicly up to this point because we haven't seen a lot of specifics from the Trump administration. But I think once even the principles, when they get laid out this week, I think we're going to see more concern expressed, not just by Democrats, but by Republicans in rural America as well. And not only that, by many of the industries, the trucking industry and others, for example. They want to make sure that when we lay out a plan for infrastructure development, that it is, in fact, going to take place.
We have a few minutes left. Tell us about a bill that you've co-sponsored, the Partnership to Build America Act.
Right. Well, the exciting part about that, from my perspective, is that it calls for some $40 billion in investment in rural broadband. And you know, Ben, since I got on the Energy and Commerce Committee, but really long before that, but given that really since I first got elected, but especially being on Energy and Commerce since January of 15, I've been able to do more on the rural broadband issue. In Iowa, for example, you know, I have these 24 counties, and sufficient bandwidth is a real problem out in the rural areas, not just in the countryside, but also in many of the small towns. Centerville, Iowa, for example, they're struggling to come back after they lost Rubbermaid. they're struggling. And when companies look to come into Centerville, one of the first questions, if not the first question they ask, is what kind of broadband do you have? It's really, really important. And so I've worked also with Republicans in rural areas to pass legislation that'll help seniors in skilled nursing facilities have better access to broadband. That's really important. But it's an economic development issue. It's an education issue. It's an agricultural development issue. It's something that is absolutely critical. And, you know, I hear some of the same concerns on that issue that I hear on the larger infrastructure issue. The incentives have to be right for companies to be able to undertake those investments. We have to be very, very careful that whatever funding goes into this, that it's a proper funding as well.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about broadband, is broadband put on the same footing as the need for better improved roads and bridges and maintenance there? Or is it seen in part as like a luxury? It would be nice to give rural Iowa the same high-speed broadband access as cities in Iowa, but, you know, we'll get there when we can. Is it really put on the same level?
I think more and more it is. And, again, it's a bipartisan approach in the U.S. House. It's not just me. It's not just Democrats. It's a lot of Republicans. And this is one area where we've had a lot of cooperation. As I said, I've gotten a couple of bills passed by partnering with Republicans on this issue. And it's I think a lot of what has to happen here, too, is we have to make sure that we convince our urban friends that rural and urban areas are not different from one another. They're not independent of one another. They're very much connected to one another. When we talk about, for example, rural broadband and trying to utilize telehealth, it may be the case that a hospital in an urban area is able to engage in telehealth with folks in rural areas. But if there's not sufficient bandwidth in the rural areas, then they're not going to be able to talk to folks there and vice versa. So, you know, we are interconnected, and I think we have to keep making that argument and keep convincing our urban friends that we are interdependent and they need us as much as we need them.
Okay, thank you very much for your time, U.S. Congressman Dave Loebsack. We appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Ben. Talk to you later.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Talking about Iowa's infrastructure this half hour. It's Infrastructure Week, as proclaimed by President Trump. And if you'd like to join our conversation, tell us a little bit about perhaps some infrastructure in needing repair in your neck of the woods. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Congressman Loebsack talked with him about the poor grades our state got on infrastructure. The report card, Iowa's roads given a C-, our bridges a D+. Those grades handed out by the American Society of Civil Engineers. Joining me now, Aaron Granquist, president of the American Society of Civil Engineers Board of Directors, also project manager at H.R. Green, Inc. Aaron Granquist, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Ben. It's a pleasure to join you.
Before we get into some details, because I know you have a lot of points of criteria there, evaluating different things there as a civil engineer. Overall, big picture, what can you say in the big picture about why Iowa is doing so poorly?
Well, I don't know that Iowa is any different than a lot of other states in this great nation of ours. I think it's just one of those things that, you know, we're kind of middle of the road, and a lot of states are in that situation or maybe even a below average grade. And it really just highlights that ongoing maintenance and continued and increasing investment is just sorely needed. I guess that's the big picture.
So we should think about it like those of us who are homeowners can think about it. Listen, if you don't invest, let's say, a few thousand every year in your house, it starts to degrade. And if, you know, at some point you can't catch up because it's so much, right?
Yeah, I mean, you got to replace your roof every, you know, 10 to 15 years, and that obviously protects everything below it. And, you know, you got to keep up with keeping the drains clean and all that stuff, or you're going to just run into issues later on.
Okay. Let's talk about this report card. And specifically for Iowa, the last report card we have is from 2015. Is that right?
Yes. Our plan is to also publish this every 4 years, similar to the national report card, which was just updated here in 2017. So we're kind of offset by a couple years, but we do plan in 2019 to revisit this and get it out there again.
And that's an important point, because this then is a report card from prior to when Iowa imposed a gas tax to fund some of the infrastructure. We'll get to that in just a moment, but I want to ask, first of all, Aaron, what is most concerning in Iowa's report on our infrastructure? What areas?
Well, there's a number of them that got, you know, some of the lowest grades. And among those are inland waterways, and Representative Lobsack, of course, talked about that with both the Mississippi and Missouri rivers on our borders. You know, having those inland waterways and the infrastructure associated with them, getting those up to par is hugely critical to our economy. As a large exporter of agricultural products, you can imagine the impact that failure there or inability to keep up with competitors can have. And certainly the dams, which also received a D, is also very concerning. You think about the high hazard dams out there and the potential impact of should one of them fail. And, it could be bad. Now, I'm not trying to say that we're all in danger of a biblical flood coming down and taking us out. But, the sheer number of those dams and unfortunately, the lack of funding and the lack of staff that's able to regularly inspect those dams is probably one of the biggest things that's concerning. Mm-hmm. And I'll just briefly touch on bridges, too. But, Representative Lobsack also talked about the bridges, and we just have a lot of them. And it's really hard to keep up, and especially on the secondary roads, which are kind of your gravel farm-to-market type roads. There's just a lot out there that are fairly old and really need to be upgraded.
Mm-hmm. Back to the dams issue, there are dams out there that are private dams, too, that are they kept track of in the same way?
They are. There's required permitting that you have to do to first of all construct, and I'm sure that there's regularly scheduled a way that those should be inspected, but right now, at least based as of 2015, the DNR only had two staff available to do regular inspections. And with as many as there are in the state, they really have to prioritize. And I'm sure they're spending most of their time looking at the high hazard dams, which have the greatest potential for risk to life, limb, and property. And so, a lot of these smaller dams that might be on private properties probably aren't looked at regularly.
Mm-hmm. Going back to bridges, from the viewpoint of a civil engineer, what happens to a bridge over time? Just briefly, in a nutshell, how does it become unsafe? What happens to the material?
Well, it depends on the type of material that it's constructed out of. I guess one example is, if it's a steel bridge with lots of welded or different types of joints, those have to be inspected for corrosion, rusting, things like that. And you have to have that as a regular part of your maintenance so you can identify issues hopefully early on. But there's also this thing called, basically a lot of the bridges are designed now with some redundancy built into them so that if one particular aspect of a bridge should fail, the whole thing won't collapse. But that wasn't the case, 40, 50 years ago. A lot of the bridges that were built and constructed back then have, fracture critical is what they're called. So if you have one member, like a pier or some part of the bridge that actually fails, then the whole thing goes down.
Mm.
And so that's why it's really critical to make sure that those get properly inspected every so often so you can see and identify those issues.
Interestingly, in the report card, there's infrastructure that we don't really see, we benefit from, under the ground. Talk about that, pipes.
Yeah, there's a lot of pipes under the ground that provide the drinking water to our homes or take the wastewater away. And, it's kind of the old saying that out of sight, out of mind, and it's not really on the consciousness of the average, John Q. public that those are issues until they have a backup or their sump pump fails or for whatever reason they have a boil order because the drinking water has been compromised in some form or fashion. And, that's certainly something that's a little bit harder to inspect and maintain because of it, the inaccessibility of getting to it. But there's a lot of managers of those types of infrastructure that know how to, you know, get a camera down in there on a little robot and kind of inspect things. And so that's one way to look at at least sanitary and sewer pipes.
As we mentioned before, Iowa raised its gas tax last year. The legislature did that. And the governor signed that into law. So we've been paying a little bit, a few pennies in our gas here to go towards upgrading our infrastructure, maintaining it. I wonder, should that improve our next report card? How quickly do we see that, or typically do you see that when you look at various states?
Well, I certainly hope it would. Now, as far as various states, it's not something that I've really been looking at to see how various investments have improved grades. I know that on the state level, these report cards are still fairly new. There's maybe a handful of states that are kind of on to their second report card. And as I mentioned, we're still a couple years out for our second one. So it remains to be seen if it'll have an impact. I'm almost assured that it will. You know, the level of increase of what's been spent out there, not just at the state level, but there's also a lot of cities that are stepping up with various forms of funding. For example, Cedar Rapids passed a local option sales tax a number of years ago, and that's helped to increase and improve their transportation system significantly. We're already seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Before we have to go in a minute or so, what are your views on, we talked with Congressman Loebsack about this, also President Trump with his infrastructure vision, $1 trillion. What should be driving that? I mean, when we talk about the federal government in there, the states, the local municipalities, the counties and so forth, what do you think is most effective?
Well, it's hard for me to have, I guess, an opinion from the civil engineer hat that I'm wearing. I tend to, on a personal level, think that funding should stay as local as possible. I think that things are spent more efficiently and more effectively that way. That being said, I think it's going to end up being a mix of federal, state, and local that need to step up to the plate on this. And I'm certainly heavily in favor of the users of the infrastructure, you know, bearing the majority of the cost, but mm-hmm. certainly society as a whole does benefit from the infrastructure being at a level we can all be proud of.
Right. Quickly, Aaron, we've only got a few seconds left. When you look at the debate happening, for instance, in Washington, are you optimistic that our infrastructure will look a lot better in 10 or 20 years? okay.
That's a good question. Let's say that I'm a bit skeptical, but who knows? You know, maybe people can recognize the issue and really step up.
Okay, I can see your fingers crossed through the telephone line. All right. Aaron Granquist, president of the American Society of Civil Engineers Board of Directors. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you much, Ben.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to focus on rural Iowa. We're going to meet an architect in Marion who believes the solution to rural economic revitalization may be through the use of old buildings by local startups. Also, Grant Gerlach and Amy Mayer of Harvest Public Media join us. Hope you'll stick around. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, of course, Politics Wednesday. Hans Hassel of Cornell College, Kedrin Bardwell of Simpson College will be joining us to survey the latest on the political landscape. Oh boy, there is, as there have been for months, every week we have so much new to talk about in terms of politics. Hope you'll join the conversation tomorrow on River to River. This half hour, our focus on rural Iowa. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll be joined by Harvest Public Media reporters Amy Mayer and Grant Gerlach. We'll discuss the Trump administration's policies so far, what they say about its relationship to rural America, how and whether Congress is making good on campaign promises to rural America. For instance, also what the subsequent farm bill might look like. The current one expires in 2018. That's coming up. But first, let's hear from an architect in Marion who believes the solution to rural economic revitalization may be through the use of old buildings by local startups. Michael LeClaire joins me in the studio in Iowa City, associate architect and associate landscape architect at Martin Gardner Architecture PC in Marion. just to mention, Martin Gardner Architecture is an underwriter at Iowa Public Radio. Michael LeClaire, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Just a very few minutes to talk about this. Sounds really interesting. And having been to Marion, a fascinating town with a great town square, a real nice mix of old and new. What are you talking about here when you say the use of old buildings, revitalization?
Well, it's a strategy to bring new life into our historic main streets, but also to maintain our connection to the historic character and the stories those old buildings tell. I always say we inherited our towns and main streets, and it's a matter of stewarding them and passing them on to another generation.
Mm-hmm. So give me an example of a building that would otherwise have been disused or not used the way it is, and how it becomes revitalized itself and how it revitalizes the community of Marion.
Well, I think both in rural and urban areas, we've seen kind of, I would say, a move to the suburbs in the last several decades and less emphasis on Main Street. Luckily, that's changing, or, you know, rural communities, populations declining, and those populations moving to urban centers. I think places like Marion and Cedar Rapids and even some of our small towns like Manchester have done a really good job at trying to fill those empty storefronts. And part of that strategy is keeping some of that historic character so that new and old can kind of complement each other and tell a bigger picture of a place.
Mm-hmm. So when the reason for the storefront died out, what do you put in there? What do we find in there in the year 2017 that's relevant to the way the town lives?
You know, there's no one answer to that, but it's to make it a flexible space so any business or entrepreneur or startup can make a home there for a time and maybe even be successful and stay there for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And so the local government has to then sort of set a framework, make it inhabitable and welcoming. What does the partnership there look like?
Well, there's a number of different kinds of partnerships. It has to do with the building owner, the business owner, the local government, and even, you know, funding sources from state and federal governments. Usually these are partnerships of all the above. And Marion, for example, is doing a project all through their main street where, you know, they got a collection of building owners and property owners, and they're running that program kind of through the city. So the structure of that changes on a case-by-case basis, but I think an important aspect is that, you know, it is doable even though it might seem unsurmountable. And that's where designers like to come in and kind of help either communities or individuals or even local governments along on that path.
Mm-hmm. So what advice would you give to someone in a small community saying, you know, I know there are beautiful buildings in our downtown. They're not being used. They could be put to use. They could revitalize our rural community. What have you learned in the process of doing this in the Marion area that you could pass on? What are some lessons learned, perhaps hard lessons learned?
Well, I guess I wouldn't say just specifically Marion, but just in Linn County and surrounding counties in general, you know, you're either dealing with a pretty established local government with full-time employees, or in our rural areas, you're dealing with a completely volunteer government for the most part. And those people work 40 hours a week. So we're dealing with different capacities to handle different workloads and different opportunities. And, you know, we like to help any size communities connect with existing resources, existing grant programs. And, you know, personally, I like doing the visioning with communities. So showing a potential before and after, and then even though that's not all the way to construction documents where a contractor can take that and make those improvements, they have a visual to, you know, gather community support and raise funds or apply for grants. And that's an easy step
Get people excited, and that's where you get your volunteer energy, isn't it?
When correct.
You can visualize, wow, this town square could be so vital.
I mean, it's an old saying, but it's true. You know, a picture speaks a thousand words. So as soon as you can get that into a community or interested party's hands, they suddenly have you know, power behind their vision versus, you know, just a good intent and some good words.
Okay. Thank you very much. Michael LeClaire, Associate Architect and Associate Landscape Architect at Martin Gardner Architecture in Marion, talking about what's been happening in Linn County. And perhaps we'll check back with you for an update and some pictures of what's been going on in those communities. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last part of our program, we're going to be joined by Amy Mayer and Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media. Grant joining us by phone. Hi, Grant. Where are you again?
I'm in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Lincoln, my birthplace.
Oh, great.
Amy Mayer, you are in Ames. Hi to you.
Hi there, Ben. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Amy. We
want to talk about a variety of things in the few minutes that are remaining here on River to River. Let's just start off here. A lot of things having to do with the ag community, rural Iowa. Start us off, Amy, with the Farm Bill. Now, Farm Bill, it's an omnibus, multi-year bill, a law that governs an array of agriculture, but also food programs is a big part of it. The most recent Farm Bill in 2014, expiring, if I'm not wrong here, in 2018. Can we talk yet about the next Farm Bill, how that's looking?
Well, those conversations certainly have begun, and senators and maybe also members of the House of Representatives have been holding field hearings on the Farm Bill. The first one was in Kansas, hosted by Senator Pat Roberts. There is a lot of talk about the Farm Bill, particularly for two reasons. One, a huge amount of President Trump's supporters in the last election lived in rural communities, many of them involved in agriculture. And secondly, President Trump's proposed budget, which he sent to Congress, proposes some significant cuts to programs that are under the rubric of the Farm Bill, including direct farm programs, but also nutrition programs.
Mm-hmm. So, Grant, what's been the reaction that in your area to the budget proposal cuts? $38 billion from Farm Bill programs, crop insurance, nutrition supports.
Yeah, some big cuts for the Department of Agriculture, and that's an agency that does a lot of work on the ground, both for farms and also for rural communities. And besides there were the cuts that would happen to the crop insurance program. That's something that farmers are really worried about. It would put caps on the amount of subsidies that farmers could receive for the insurance that the government helps pay for, and also for the size of farms in terms of income that would receive the subsidies to help them pay for crop insurance. And at this point, that is the main safety net for farmers. So they're pretty protective of that. That's what helps them pay the bills if the crop doesn't come in, if there's some disasters in terms of the weather. So they're watching that very closely. Something that's a little smaller that has been watched closely in rural areas too is proposed cuts to rural development programs. And those include some stuff that's pretty important for rural towns. There's a water infrastructure program that would be zeroed out, and also a business and cooperative development program that does a lot of work in rural communities that would be zeroed out too. Now, that's just the president's proposal. All of that could come back by the time Congress works through this whole thing. Mm-hmm. But when rural development agencies and workers look at that, they're concerned about where the administration plans to go when it comes to its promise to rebuild rural America.
Mm-hmm. Grant and Amy, yeah, you said it right there, Grant. President Trump getting elected in large part in the rural parts of the U.S. by promising to revive rural communities. Based on what we heard in the campaign, are farmers, people in ag communities, seeing a match between what the president is proposing and what he campaigned on, Amy?
I think you can get a lot of different answers to that question, because as much as we like to talk about rural voters or the agricultural vote, farmers are not a monolith.
Mm-hmm.
I visited with a farmer in Hamilton County earlier this spring, and she was clearly a Trump supporter and had a lot of frustrations to hurl at what she called obstructionist Democrats. On the other hand, I also met with a farmer who's the president of the Iowa Farmers Union, an organization that tends to lean a little more to the left. And he was actually happy that Trump had pulled out of the TPP, which is something that was actually pretty popular with many farmers.
Right.
But the National Farmers Union didn't support it. On the other hand, there were several other things that those sort of left-leaning farmers were not thrilled about.
Mm-hmm. Trade is a big issue because of those farmers, a lot of exports in both Nebraska and here in Iowa, Grant. How are the people you're talking to feeling about President Trump's move on these trade issues, NAFTA, TPP?
Well, there's been a lot of concern and some relief in certain situations, a little bit of whiplash on how some things have moved. I mean, on the one hand, it did pull out of the TPP. That was a campaign promise on both sides, so they kind of saw that coming. But they were hoping that that would do things like lower tariffs for beef in Japan, which they've been working on for years and years. On the other hand, there was the recent announcement as Governor Branstad goes to China to be the ambassador there, that China will open up for exports of American beef to their country,
mm-hmm.
which hasn't happened since 2003 when there was a BSE outbreak in the U.S. or a case of BSE, mad cow disease. American beef hasn't been in China since then, and now next month it could be back, which beef producers in Nebraska and Iowa consider a big deal. And then you go back the other way, and NAFTA is going to be renegotiated, and those talks are going to be going on. And there was a trade group from Mexico that came to Lincoln several weeks ago and stood up with our governor, with Nebraska farmers, and said, just leave it alone. you can change what you need to, but when it comes to agriculture, leave it alone. And that's sort of the message they're trying to get across to the administration when it comes to NAFTA.
Mm-hmm. I don't have sort of the visual of the pie chart in my head, but perhaps either one of you can help me out. We talk a lot about trade with China, important to Iowa, but really, you know, Canada and Mexico is where it's at for Iowa. Ag, isn't it?
It is, except when it comes to soybeans. China is a huge market for soybeans. Amy, the number that comes to mind is $20 billion. Does that sound right at all?
I wouldn't want to judge. I'm not
sure.
But
you wanted,
huge.
You wanted to jump in there, too. We talk a lot about China, but really are a lot of trade here in the North American continent.
I was going to say the same thing, that we do have major, major trade with Canada and Mexico, but China is a major trading partner. We're seeing increasing markets, particularly for pork in Japan and South Korea. And then we also see from some fluctuation. Iowa is the U.S.'s largest egg producer, and we had a major problem with bird flu 2 years ago here where we mm-hmm. There were some quick negotiations with allies to import some eggs. But similarly, South Korea was dealing with an avian influenza outbreak earlier this year, late last year, and we had not been a big we hadn't been exporting a lot of eggs to South Korea, but we were able to get into that market. So as much as we rely on certain big major trading partners for certain commodities, there's also a certain appreciation for being a little bit nimble to be able to jump in when an opportunity presents itself.
Back to this new administration, Grant, you've been reporting on, is it the reorganization of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and how Midwestern farmers are looking at it through that lens?
And that brings a couple of these things together, both rural development and the trade issue. One of the big moves is to create an undersecretary for foreign trade at USDA, which would be in charge of, trying to make deals and agreements in countries like China or South Korea. But on the other hand was the removal of an undersecretary for rural development. Now, that was not a one-to-one trade-off. They did not have to remove the Undersecretary for Rural Development in order to create the Undersecretary for Trade, but that's the decision that the new Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue, has made and plans to move forward with. He says that rural development will basically be right outside his office door, and the person in charge of that can come in at any time and ask him for approval for different project ideas. But on top of the budget proposal that makes such significant cuts to rural development programs, people who work in small towns on business development and other things are wondering if those projects will get the same amount of attention from someone who is as busy as the ag secretary.
Mm-hmm. Amy, you reported back, we talked about the ag secretary, you reported back in March that Corn Belt farmers had some concerns over whether Midwest farming interests, Sonny Perdue from the South, would be considered in Washington. How are farmers feeling a few months into this administration?
The farmers that I've talked to were not terribly concerned in that they recognized having their own former governor as the head of USDA was sort of a unique position to be in with Tom Vilsack. And Secretary Vilsack served the full Obama administration. So 8 years of having a guy who you feel like really knows what you grow and knows how you function, that's pretty exceptional. And although I will say, just this morning I was on a reporter conference call with Senator Chuck Grassley, and he was expressing some concern that when it comes time to ultimately reconciling a Senate farm bill with a House farm bill, in the last cycle, he felt Southern agriculture was really dominant in that conference committee, but Tom Vilsack was able to do what he could to try to mitigate any perception of an over-focus on the South. Mm-hmm. And Senator Grassley seemed a little bit concerned that the Midwest could be vulnerable this go-round if a similar situation arises and the sort of mediating party is Sonny Perdue, who has his experience in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Of course, nationally, immigration is talked about a lot. How does that overlap with our ag communities here in the Midwest? Anything from, you know, the renewed talk of by the president of the attempt at a travel ban to immigration policies, stricter enforcement by ICE, and so forth. Is this what kind of impact is this having, Amy and Grant, that you're seeing?
Well, for sure, immigrant workers are very important to the ag industry, both in, in slaughterhouses in Iowa, Nebraska. They sort of make use of that stream of refugees that come through our communities. These are low-skilled jobs that they find they can do when they first arrive to the U.S. and hopefully can work up to something different. I haven't heard anything in terms of specific acute troubles at this point, mm-hmm. as these sort of policies change at this time, but definitely concern within those communities.
And I think we are also seeing in some of the communities that we report on that there is increased interest in or attendance at English language classes or citizenship classes. So some of the refugees or other immigrants who are not yet U.S. citizens and maybe we're not in a hurry to pursue that, are now trying to put a little more pressure on themselves to move in that direction, because mm-hmm. obviously once they're citizens, they aren't, they have a lot less to worry about.
Amy, let's talk a minute or two about the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. That was on the chopping block until a last-second save there. What is the future of this center?
Well, that's a question that a lot of farmers have right now, and I think a lot of researchers also have that question. The reason it's still unknown is at the point of signing the bills, then-Governor Branstad vetoed the line item that would have shut down the Leopold Center, but he allowed to pass the language that eliminated the funding. And the way the law was written, the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at Iowa State is now officially overseeing the Leopold Center, managing any money that it has, any budget that it may have. There are projects underway that will need to be concluded. The College of Ag is going to have to manage those. And then it was left a little bit ambiguous what the College of Ag ultimately could either grant to the Leopold Center in terms of funding or kind of allow the Leopold Center to do. And so there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of concern right now about both existing projects and whether there will be future projects.
Mm-hmm. I talked weeks ago with the director of the Leopold Center when this was also still in question. But give us a sense, for those of us who are not out on the farm, the Leopold Center represents what? How integral is it to the future of farming here, Amy?
The Leopold Center was created in 1987 at a time when there was a lot of concern about the environmental impact of farming. At the time, the conversations were a little bit different than the conversations we're having now, but that's partly because of the impact that the Leopold Center's research has had. So a lot of waterways that were being directly polluted, I can't get into all of the details, but there were certain habits that were happening that are no longer happening. There were certain concerns that have been addressed, and now the Leopold Center has presented research that demonstrates demonstrates additional conservation practices that could help with some of our current river contamination problems in terms of nitrates flowing downriver toward the Des Moines Water Works, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Well,
yeah.
We have to go, Amy. Thank you very much, Amy Mayer and Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media. Quick flyover of some of the issues facing the agriculture sector. Grant, Amy, thank you so much for helping out.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Nick Brinks and Helena Thompson as well. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, Politics Wednesday, packed full of new things you've been seeing and hearing on the news. We hope you'll tune in and join our discussion tomorrow for Politics Day with Kedrin Bardwell and Hans Hassel. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.